Sermons from the Journey is the audio podcast of the weekly message preached by Reverend Becca Gorell, pastor at Lebanon United Methodist Church in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and blogging at pastorbecca.com. Thanks for listening.
Again, this week I was doing some gardening behind the parsonage and cleaning out around the yard. And it was in the process of that that I noticed, actually Sean noticed it first because he has a very sharp eye, what appeared to be a beautiful plant growing along the right-hand side of the edge of the yard. A plant with a delicate and lovely vine and these spreading leaves that looked so nice and gentle. A beautiful, deep purple flower with a bright yellow throat. An elegant, elongated, at this point, bright green, which is a good thing because it means they're unripe, bright green berries in little clusters. The plant is deadly nightshade, used in the past for a narcotic, not very safely because it's also been used for a poison, deadly to children and small animals. Although, in hindsight, now that I've removed it all, I bet that's probably why nothing has eaten any of the other plants in the yard, and now I'm going to have problems with squirrels and bunnies and things, I bet. But live and learn. And so, of course, being a fierce mama lion, as I tend to be, I was like, well, we're not going to have a plant that's poisonous to children in the yard. And so I began to rip it out, and the best course of action that I can tell is to try to just pull out as much of the root as you can, because otherwise if you put anything to kill it, you're going to kill other stuff, and that sort of defeats the purpose of what I was trying to accomplish. So I just pulled and pulled and pulled the nightshade, starting out at the edge where the flowers and the berries were, because I could see those, and working my way back into the undergrowth and finding the roots under the trees and the ground cover and the bushes. And it went pretty well for about two-thirds of the patch of nightshade because it was just tangled up with some creeping Charlie, totally harmless little ground cover that, you know, I wasn't too attached to one way or the other. Since I didn't care about the rest of it, just pulled the whole thing out and it was fine. But about two-thirds of the way through, I got to a patch of black raspberries. Now, I like black raspberries. I really, you know, those are some good berries, and those are good to eat. Now, you definitely don't want the poisonous berries and the good berries all tangled together in the same area, because they don't want, you know, kids to be picking some berries that are good to eat and not know which are which. We have a rule. We bring the berries in and wash them and check them first. But still, you know, don't want to be out grazing and having to figure out, oh, was that a nightshade or a blackberry? And so I pruned more gently, right? I pulled more gently, trying to separate out the nightshade vine, which is a pretty tricky, twisty little vine that likes to wrap around things, from the black raspberry bush, which has a different problem, which is that it's prickly and thorny, and, you know, so it's cutting my fingers, and the nightshade's wrapping around it, and trying to separate those things out. And I thought, my goodness, God is giving me sermon material for the weeds and the wheat. At this moment, I learned a few things, or was reminded, really, of a few things that we all already know. One is that we can't judge things by the way they look. The nightshade plant is beautiful. Its vine is elegant, its leaves are delicate, its flower is breathtakingly beautiful. Even its berries look so attractive and lovely, and then they turn this deep, almost the color purple of the water I was using in the children's time, but they turn this very deep purple black color. But you know, right now they're a brilliant green, like chartreuse green, just lots of vibrancy and color and beauty and elegance to this plant that if one were to ingest it, even as an adult, would make you quite sick, could make you quite sick, and certainly for smaller creatures is, as its name suggests, deadly. Whereas the black raspberry bush has its thorns and its prickers, and it's not as elegant to look at. Its leaves are just a little bit more plain, and as it got stepped on, it really started to look less and less elegant. And its berries come in the little clusters. They actually look really nice and red when they're not ripe, and you have to wait for them to get a similar dark color to be ripe. And it doesn't look as beautiful or as elegant. But one of these plants is life-giving and delicious, and one is dangerous. So we can't judge things by what they look like, and we know that, but always a good reminder. The second was that it was just plain hard. It was just hard to separate out the good plant from the bad plant. Right? It was just hard to pull apart that which gives life from that which takes life. And the reminder that sometimes those things get all twisted up. Their roots were twisted up together. Their branches and vines were twisted up together. That sometimes those things which are life-giving and those things which are life-sucking get mixed up and interwoven and intertwined in life. And that this is inescapable, but true. Like the workers in the field, in the parable that Jesus tells about the weeds and the wheat, we ask ourselves, how does this happen? And that landowner gives an external, an enemy did it. Okay. But they don't spend a lot of time. In fact, they don't spend any time then looking for that enemy and shaking their fists and saying, why, oh, why, oh, why are there weeds among the wheat? It just is. And the question now is, what do we do? What do we do with that truth, with that reality? It just is. That the nightshade and the black raspberry are growing together, that life has its beautiful moments and its poisonous moments, and they're just woven together. And the third thing was what I was saying about the method of pulling out the vine. It was easy to recognize out at the end. Out at the end where it was bearing flowers and fruit, I could see and tell which was which. But back down, I had to follow it back down into the brambles, down to the roots, where they didn't look as different. It wasn't as easy to tell at the beginning of the plant, at the origin of it, what it was going to be. Only when it had grown enough to really show its true colors, only when it had grown enough to reveal what kind of fruit it would bear, could I see and tell apart the life-giving, if prickly, black raspberry from the elegant but deadly nightshade. And this, too, is truth. That sometimes when things happen, we can't tell in the moment when we're right in the thick of things if it's good or bad or indifferent, and it's not really up to us to determine that, but to let it play out, let it grow, let what will be, and see what comes of it, and judge for ourselves, or even better yet, let God judge how things have fallen out. I've overstepped the metaphor of the parable because I did pull out the plants rather than wait for the harvest and just mow the whole thing down. So we won't push it too far. Susie and I read the two Psalms, most of Psalm 22. It keeps going in that vein for quite a while, but a lot of Psalm 22 and Psalm 23, with which people are more familiar. And I love that these two psalms come side by side, or front and back of a page in a Bible, right? My favorite Bibles, it's pretty cool when, like, Psalm 22 is on the back of one page and you turn the page and Psalm 23 is on the other side, because it's a reminder that if you don't like Psalm 22 and you want to rip it out, you can't, because you'd get Psalm 23 too, right? But I love the ones where Psalm 22 is on the left side of the page and Psalm 23 is on the right side of the page, and these two vastly different experiences of faith. That feeling of having been forsaken and abandoned by the very one who should hold us as a good shepherd. And that feeling of being protected and provided for by the one that someone else felt had abandoned them are side by side. And when you close the book, the pages touch, the pages kiss, they are pressed together like hands clasped in prayer, like lovers embracing. The two parts of that experience of faith pressed together whenever a Bible rests on a table, on a shelf. And I love that truth because life is like that too. We can't pull out one psalm. We wouldn't do that anyway. But we can't pull out one psalm without ripping out the other. We can't close the Bible without those experiences touching, being so cared for and provided for feeling so betrayed and forsaken. And these two psalms are intricately interwoven for us in the Christian tradition into the life of Christ. We can see very clearly how Psalm 23 speaks, although written about God, God in general, the Lord is my shepherd. We hear that psalm, many of us, about Jesus specifically, that image of Jesus as the good shepherd walking with us through the valley of the shadow of death, as Jesus did walk through that shadowed valley, right? And being with us, providing for us, nurturing and caring for and tending us. And we see that as a psalm that speaks to us about Jesus as well, just as much as the psalmist wrote it about God as a whole, about how it becomes specific for us about the person of Christ. But it's Psalm 22 that references for us, we see those tie-ins to Jesus' death. Right? It talks about enemies standing around and gloating and saying to one suffering, cry out to God if you are God's favorite and let God save you. Just as we are told the Roman soldier said at the foot of Jesus' cross, if you are the Son of God, then cry out and ask to be taken down from your cross, ask to be delivered, and God will rescue you. And it speaks of those same enemies or different enemies as they gloat, as they jeer, dividing up the garments of the one who is suffering, casting lots and gambling for that person's outer cloak, just as we're told those soldiers did at the foot of Jesus' cross, gambling for his garments, casting lots for his cloak. And the psalm starts with words that are on Jesus' lips. On that cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. My God, why have you forsaken me? Those two parts of how we imagine Jesus, the loving shepherd and the suffering one, pressed together, side by side, whenever we close the book. The weeds and the wheat grow together. And we look for the enemy that's sown the weeds, but only for a moment, because that's not going to do us any good. It's not going to do us any good to spend our lives trying to track down that person and punish them. Our human sense of justice and vengeance tells us that that would feel really good. That it would feel really good to find the person who shoots a missile and shoots down a plane, and punish that one. But it will not bring back the 295 people shot down over the Ukraine. It will not bring back the third of them that were the top researchers and advocates combating AIDS globally. It will not undo the fact that the nightshade grows and the weeds are interwoven with the wheat, and Psalm 22 comes right before Psalm 23 because those things are already true. And so searching for the enemy and tracking them down doesn't undo the truth of life. And it's not ours to try to pull apart all of those things as I tried to pull apart the nightshade and the black raspberry. Because they grow together. There are philosophies and religions that teach us to try to detach from the good and the bad of life, to try to cultivate a kind of lack of caring about how hard and painful things can be. There are maybe impulses inside us that also encourage this, right? If I didn't care so much, it would be easier. Like when I didn't care if I pulled out the round cover that wasn't black raspberry, it was so much easier to just accept that as a casualty of war as I waged my war against the nightshade vine. But life's not like that. And Jesus doesn't ever tell people to do that. There's not a single story where Jesus tells people, yeah, it's okay, just don't care about that. Have less passion in life. Have less concern and compassion for others. If you don't love, you'll never be hurt. If you don't trust in God, you'll never have to feel that God has forsaken you. There's not a page of the Bible that says that. there might be a little bit in Job, but that's like bad advice that friends are giving Job is, you know, like, well, then just walk away, curse God and die and that kind of thing. But the good advice, the positive message of the Bible, of Jesus' life, of the story of our faith is never to just detach, never to call what feels wrong and painful and sad and evil anything other than what it is. Never to call what feels good and beautiful and right and true anything other than what it is. Only to acknowledge that they grow together. And that when we close the Bible, the pages touch. Whether it's a plane full of people that goes down tragically, whether it's busloads of children with no home and no place to go except back to war and gang violence and near certain death. These things are real and painful and wrong and bad, and we name them so. And whether it's the smile or the tender compassion of a friend or the glorious miracle of a new child born or the hope and healing that grows out of loss. These things are good and beautiful and whole and life-giving, and we name them so. I was already familiar with the story that is so deeply tied to the DNA of this church, but I've heard it again a few times from a few of you this week. The story of loss, of fire, of grief, of pain, of losing something so precious and sacred as the church itself. And I've heard from the same people in the same breath or the very next breath the hope of rebirth. What a powerful resurrection story. The story not only of rebuilding, but of a family, a community coming together, born really out of that experience, not arguing or struggling, but finding new strength and new life. We would not name a fire good, and we would not name the beautiful rebirth that happened after bad, or say that neither matters, but that they grow together. And that is life, and that is how it is. The weeds and the wheat, those experiences are intertwined. The Psalms remind us God's provision and that feeling of being abandoned and forgotten are side by side. Life grows together in this mixed up and messy way. And as one person said to me this week, you don't get over it. You just get through it. We just continue. We let life grow together. We let God sort out the details. We don't name good or bad, pain or joy as anything other than what they are. We are honest. But we hold on. And we wait. And we tend the best of ourselves that we can. As we live this mixed up, tangled together, beautiful, broken, messy, glorious, God-filled life. Amen.